You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 6th of October 2012 here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. A nicely bound magazine from the Bosporus, a new resource for decoration and design, a commander of a creative agency, and a gentleman who knows a thing or two about tinkering with bikes and the printed word. All that ahead on Edition 6 of The Stack. Also ahead on the program, we speak to former Condé Nast editorial director James Truman about everything from the golden years of magazines to the state of media today.
Yeah, I mean, I've come to look at magazines really as being like department stores. I mean, they stay in business, but you wonder why, since you couldn't get everything in them somewhere else. And you know how magazines get out of that sort of department store crisis is really going to be the story of the next 10 years, and there's not an easy path out.
And we head to Japan to hear how you can build a business selling free newspapers.
When we started our business with three of us, we collected around 100 kinds of free papers. Now we have 100 to 120 kinds of them.
All that and a few more reading tips today on Edition 6 of The Stack, live from Studio One in London. Hello and welcome to Edition 6 of The Stack, the newest addition to our wake-up lineup here on Monocle 24, and one that's devoted to all that's glorious about glue, fine paper, ink, lovely newsagents, and tucking into a good pile of periodicals. This week, we sent the November issue of Monocle off to the printers in Dorset. We had a host of lovely visitors from New York, and we also set up our own newsstand. More on that a little bit later, but first, our guests around the table here in Studio One. And as ever on The Stack, we're joined by two print industry experts here in Studio One at Midori House. Our first guest is the editor of cycling magazine Roulure. Over the past 15 years, Guy Andrews has written several books on the subject of bicycle maintenance and the building of custom bicycles and describes himself as a competitive road biker. Guy, welcome to The Stack. I wanted to start. I first came across the magazine in Sweden at one of my absolute favorite stores, which is Papercut, and I want to know sort of the takeoff of the title. Was it something on these shores in the UK, or was it something which was a success internationally first?
I think, certainly the UK has been very strong for us, but interesting you mentioned Papercut, because Papercut were one of our first international retailers. And I think the retailers that have supported us have all pushed the magazine to their audience. And I think internationally that growth has been, I think partly because we were new to the market and we were very very specialised in cycling and in road cycling particularly, and it was a market that wasn't particularly flooded with quality magazines. So obviously I'm going to say it wasn't easy, but I think from that point of view, we got a following fairly quickly, especially internationally.
Great. Also, our second guest is the founder of the Church of England, not the Church of England, but a creative agency and publisher of the award-winning magazines like Little White Lies and Huck. The Church of England has also worked with Google to produce Think Quarterly, the limited edition magazine that brings together some of the world's leading minds to discuss the issues facing businesses today. Danny Miller, welcome to The Stack.
Thank you, Tyler.
I want to talk about let's not talk about Google. Google gets enough attention. We'll talk about them later. Just describe where your agency sits within the London or maybe sort of broader European creative landscape.
Yeah, it's actually the Church of London. We get confused with the Church of England a lot.
I'm absolutely apologizing.
No, that's all right. That's quite all right. In fact, as well as that, we often get confused generally with other religious organizations. We have people calling us to ask if they can take photos of our cemetery and other such things. So where we sort of fit within the scheme of things. Well, we started as a straight-up magazine publisher, making our own mags, Little White Lies and Huck. And then we kind of became a bit of a design agency as well. So we used to, because we made Little White Lies and it was a movie mag, I would go in and speak to a lot of film companies and ask them if we could design movie posters or DVD covers, that kind of thing. And that kind of span off into us making magazines for other people. So we started making magazines first for, again, Curzon Cinemas, who have five cinemas around London, and then for other companies that we came into contact with through Little White Lies and Huck. And then, yeah, that's sort of just, we've grown organically ever since, really.
Let's maybe start, Guy, with you and just tell us, what have you brought into? We'll probably go in through the magazines, but let's have a little preview. What's in your stack for us today?
Well, in my stack, I've got O'Cumley and also Carl's Cars. I mean, Carl's Cars has been around for quite a while, so it's not a new magazine as such. But they're the two I brought in today.
And what have you got for us over there?
I brought in Tissue Magazine, which I did a little recce of our office yesterday and looked for things that were really new that I hadn't seen at all before. So I brought in Tissue Magazine. I brought in a magazine called Mahala, which I was given by someone who came into our office very recently from South Africa. And I have also brought in Delayed Gratification, which is a slight cheat because I know that Rob was on the show last week, but I really love Delayed Gratification, so...
Excellent. I want to talk a little bit about consumption. I mean, you said you did a quick spin around the office. What are your current sort of consumption habits? Is it a deal with a local news agent and getting everything you want sort of sent round? Is it global subscriptions, or is it still actually going to a much loved newsstand for you?
Do you know what? It's interesting that you should ask that. We were just talking about that this morning before we came in, and I found recently that I haven't got as many magazines in front of me as I want to have. There are an awful lot kicking around our office, and they tend to get sent to various people, and they pile up in certain corners, and I go and grab them when I can. But it is very rare that I will go out to a newsagent and start browsing for things. I think I find most things through websites and Twitter feeds online, where I sort of get more of a sense of what kind of a magazine it is, what are the people who are like behind it, and then I'll go out and seek it out in certain places. I was actually in.
Would you buy online?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have certain subscriptions set up in the office. There are things that are always arriving there. But I guess I probably just steal from my colleagues for the most part.
Guy?
To be honest with you, we get all the cycling magazines sent into the office, and we do have a few subscriptions to other mags. But generally speaking, I tend to spend most of my time looking at older stuff, which probably isn't what you want to hear. But I say that's one of the reasons why I bought O'Cumley in, is that's probably the most up-to-date magazine that I look at regularly. Obviously, the guys from Church of London, just around the corner from us, the office, so occasionally when I pop into there, I pick up all their mags. So it's one of those things, again, I suppose, as Danny and I were just saying, as an editor of a magazine, generally speaking, you're very much focused on what you're up to. It's rare that we get a chance to have a really good look at what's available. So this has been quite an interesting process, even just this morning, just looking at what we bought in.
But when you said you look at older magazines, then is that for purely for design cues more than anything else, as opposed to, bicycle technology has evolved, but we're still talking about sort of a crank and two wheels. So
we are. I mean, I think that's why it always amazes me that we can manage to fill a magazine. But specifically, I bought in a car magazine from Italy in 1959, and we were just saying what's amazing is how much information is in there, compared to how much information you get in a more contemporary magazine. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm always attracted to those kind of mags. I mean, I always look at old Parry Matches and Vu and old I'd say probably more the reportage style magazines that give more of a bigger picture of stories. And I think that's the problem with a lot of modern mags. That's my view anyway, is I always think that the story always leaves me wanting more, which is probably why I always look back, which is not always the best thing to do.
No, we're going to look at a retail concept in a moment, but I wanted to just ask, both of you, just given where your titles sit, I mean, just beautiful additions, which, again, there's so much craft and care that goes into them. And I'm wondering, we mentioned Papercut at the top of the show. We've seen this rise of the specialist newsstand, all over Europe. And, you can go to the likes of sort of Do You Read Me, and you've seen what Tsutaya has done in Tokyo, and there's Paper Cup in Beirut. I mean, there's so many different places that are doing this now. I mean, do you think that's because the newsstand, the traditional newsstand, just became so boring that we had a reaction. And I'm wondering what came first. And I guess I'll go to you first with this. Do you think sort of the specialist newsstand evolved and then created an environment for titles, you know, like yours, or was it the other way around?
Hard to say. I think retail's changed, and I think that's probably the first point to make. And I think that's, you know, going to any high street newsagent all around the world, and you're probably more likely to buy a bag of sweets than you will actually get a decent newspaper or magazine. So I think that's partly it. And I think also there's a huge enthusiasm to want to produce print media, which I find massively encouraging. I mean, we did an evening the other night where there were many, many young people came and just wanted to ask questions about how to produce a magazine, which to me was, you know, it was absolutely inspirational, because I think a lot of the problem now is that people want to create something, but they're not really sure where to start. And, I think the usual routes into the media now are tricky. So I think I think that's what's probably born this flurry of independent magazines. Mm.
Danny, what do you think?
Yeah, I think we come into the contact with the same kind of thing as you, Guy, where there are so many people that want to make magazines. And the way we look at publishing these days is that we think only the most beautiful, the most considered magazines are the ones that will survive. And I think that they need a sort of shopping experience, which is more of an experience, really, where people can go in, browse, take some time, look around, where magazines have like good frontage so that actually can be seen their full covers. So I think that magazines demand that, really. Mm. And I think it is a response to these beautiful special mags like the ones that we brought along today, and so many others that you'll see in a place like, but just like Magma in the UK, that it requires that kind of shopping experience.
Well, we're going to look at a retail concept of a different kind. In Shibuya, Japan, lies the concept store Only Free Paper. Usually a store will try to sell you something, but this concept store only sells free newspapers and magazines. While mass digitalization has caused huge problems for the publishing industry, the free paper industry is one that is positively thriving, both in Japan and many other markets around the world. We went to speak to the shop's owner, Kenichi Matsue, to find out the secret behind the store's success.
Only Free Paper のオーナーやってます松江と申します。よろしくお願いします。設立は2000
We founded Only Free Paper in December 2010. The first man who came up with this idea was Ishizaki, the previous owner, who is a crazy free paper collector. He loved magazines and he accumulated enormous amount of free papers. He wanted to run a bookshop focused on art books, but there are plenty of them already. So he took another look at the piles of paper in his place and decided to focus on free paper. That's how we kicked off. There is a side of the shop that is a library area where you can enjoy not to be taken free papers in the shop. This collection on this side is what you can take away for free. When we started our business, with three of us, we collected around 100 kinds of free papers. Now we have 100 to 120 kinds of them. Occasionally, people from overseas bring or post their free papers to us too. Recently, free papers have been increasingly featuring local cities and small towns, especially after the earthquake and tsunami last year. More and more people have started speaking out from their local towns, bypassing Tokyo instead of using it as a mass communications hub. I guess Japan hasn't reached the critical mass in terms of digital tablets or e-books yet, or at least as much as Western countries have. The power of paper is still surviving amid the digital age. Many Japanese still love papers. They look after things so well and have a strong sense of ownership. The fact that paper is a substance that's great to touch also means it's something we love to hold on to for as long as possible. We had a business model when we kicked off, but a project like this has never existed before, so we try and experiment with one model after another. We feel like we're not too different from web services in terms of who we are, since web services don't necessarily generate profits immediately. We started off wanting to do something unique and fun, so we didn't think too much about making profit out of it. But surely we'll need to establish a business scheme to keep ourselves running. We're thinking about a model that connects information and people that come into this place with the outside world, rather than monetizing it here. We've also got a website, so we're building a business scheme to monetize, including an e-book service. No catalogs, no recruitment pamphlets or commercial booklets are accepted here. It's a bookshop, but the only different thing is that everything is free. So as long as it's a publication, any genre is welcome.
And that was the owner of Only Free Paper in Japan, Kenichi Matsue. Before we go to a break, I just wanted to ask both of you, Danny, do you think that there is almost sort of, you know, two big gulfs in the world, and the sort of, you know, the gulf between North America and Europe, and then sort of another one between Asia, because he was talking about also, you know, that there hasn't sort of been quite the rise in e-readers and mass digitalization in Japan that you've seen elsewhere in the world. And I say that just, you know, in reference to, and as I said at the top of the show, we had a lot of people from New York here this week, and everyone's sort of asking about, God, you know, like, you know, what do we do about print? And oddly, it sort of seems that everyone only listens to kind of the West Coast of the United States. So therefore, you sort of believe that everything that's proclaimed in San Jose has to be sort of true.
Sure, yeah.
And yet, people are sort of surprised when you say, and you know, one thing we're widely covering this week was just the fact that in Germany, very healthy media market, one of the biggest economies in the world, but, you know, e-reader book sales are only like 2%. I mean, it's absolutely tiny compared to sort of 50% of the US.
Yeah, I mean, that's surprising to hear, really. And I think a lot of people are just taking time to, I mean, for me, I'm so confused by the number of formats and ways that I can be consuming any given magazine or book. It's like the book that we make for Google, you know, it goes out in so many different platforms, so many different ways. And I feel like I personally am someone who's kind of taking a little bit of time out to figure out which one I want to use. So it's surprising to hear that consumption in that way isn't as high in Japan, because you feel like they would be the early adopters. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't speak from a position of experience about any sort of gulf between different territories, but yeah, that's interesting, definitely.
What is your impression, and just also looking through the back of the magazine, I mean, where you're sort of available and in stock, I mean, how do you see things at the moment?
I think it's interesting that, I mean, you bring up Germany as a case in point. I mean, Germany's got a massive cycling market, but we don't sell that many, because I think there is a bit of a tendency not to want to use a credit card on the internet in Germany for some bizarre reason.
But, very true.
I think that probably doesn't help, but I think also as well, I mean, I've just been in Germany at a trade show, and there's still the want to actually pick up catalogues at that sort of thing is seems to be quite prevalent. So I actually think they're probably more based in real life publishing than they are in online publishing. I think online for that market maybe is based around browsing at things as opposed to buying. So I think maybe that's, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a specialist. I mean, obviously print is what I'm all about. So the online market for me is always a bit confusing, but I think that's certainly how we see it.
Mm. Well, yeah, we're just canvassing that opinion every week. I think we want to be one of the programs that's chronicling it. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're going away for a short break. We're back in a moment.
A careful attention to detail helps define the clothing that J.Crew makes. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchens explains, creating the best products often means approaching the design process through an unconventional lens, bringing together the best materials in the world with bold, smart designs.
To us, it's always striving for the best. It's about fit and design and color and fabric, and about working with the best mills and factories in the world. And in men's, you have to be persistent and consistent. All these values get translated by being obsessive about details, whether it's replicating a cool vintage button for a work shirt or shaping the armhole of our Ludlow jacket. So we question all components of a garment, and even the amount of stitches per inch can make a huge difference.
J.Crew.
For decades, Detroit has been a poster child for the misfiring American dream. But amid block after block of post-industrial decline, there are signs that Motor City is jump-starting its economy, as Monocle Films discovers.
The phrase triple bottom line echoes around the city among small business operators. There is a dual desire, a sense of pride even, to make a success not only for themselves, but also for Detroit.
Retooling Motor City, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24, where we're joined around the table by Guy Andrews, who is the editor and founder of Roulure, and also by Danny Miller of the Church of London Creative Agency. Danny, at the start of the program, I was saying it in sort of a light way, that you've also been doing some work for Google, and you just mentioned that before the break as well. Just tell us a little bit about that project then before you get into the magazines you've assembled in front of you.
Sure, yeah. Well, It's a project that came to us in a quite remarkable and unexpected way. We were asked to, as an agency, as a sort of customer publishing agency, we were asked to pitch for it a couple of years ago. And it's a thought leadership publication that Google make. It goes out around the world to the CEOs and the CMOs of big companies that Google are working with.
So it's not found on newsstand. It's a rare object.
Yeah, it's printed in very low run, and every single copy is personalized. So we use an Indigo digital press to make each cover have the name of the recipient worked somehow into it, and then those are case bound and couriered out to people. And one of the difficult things with the book, and one of the reasons for this personalization, is because one of the goals was to actually get it to the CEO, to actually find a way to get through to them so that they could read it, because Google absolutely knew and were confident that if they could get a beautiful piece of printed matter in front of these people, that they would take the time to read it and read it all. And subsequent research has shown that they do. But it was kind of like, how do we get it to these people? How do we get it past their bank of PAs and secretaries and whatnot? So it's been we're incredibly lucky to have worked on the project. It's been like the biggest learning experience and also very difficult.
But amazing for a company like that, as you said, to get the cut through, that they still have to resort to ink and paper, which is
absolutely
quite remarkable.
And it has worked for them fantastically well.
Excellent. Now, you've got delayed gratification in front of you, which we spent quite a bit of time on last week. So you can have 10 seconds to talk about that and why you brought it in today. But then you've got so many other good things that I wanted to get into those a little bit later.
Okay, I'll do 10 seconds. Well, I like everything about delayed gratification. It's a wonderful magazine that has a very defined purpose for its existence,
go on, sorry.
No, do you know what? That's all I need to say.
Okay,
I like that about it, so okay. I will leave it there.
Tell us quickly about Tissue then before we go over to Guy.
Okay, well, full disclosure, I only picked up Tissue yesterday on the recce of the office that I previously mentioned, so I don't know a great deal about it. This is issue one, and the first thing that drew me to it was the beautiful cover. It's got a very refined use of spot varnish on it and this beautiful texture. It's I don't want to call it a pornographic magazine. It describes itself as everything sexy, and yeah, I guess it is a kind of different kind of pornographic magazine. I want to use a better word or adjective to describe it, but it's just really beautiful.
Erotica.
Erotic. There is a far better word. Yeah, it's beautifully paced. It's beautifully designed. It has like a real sort of through running feel to it. There's like a blue wash over much of this issue. There's some great use of different paper stocks, some great photography, and it's just the feel of it, which I think is really interesting, and also the fact that
just pass it across. Sorry.
Sure. And I can't say I'm an expert in erotica magazines of any kind, but just the fact that it's doing something different with that feel feels really interesting, and the fact that it's sort of it's grabbing people's attention with something that they wouldn't. I don't think any of us would go into a magazine store and browse for this. Well, I'll speak for myself. Browse for this kind of a magazine. But the fact that it's jumping out and doing that, I think, is a really good thing.
Mm. I can't find a cover price on it. But yeah, as you said, it's absolutely beautifully produced. And maybe, so it was issue one. I would imagine that maybe advertisers, might rally around at some point. But no advertising I can see it for the moment.
No, I don't think there's anything.
Beautifully printed in Germany.
Where else?
Guy, what do you have?
I bought O Comely, which is now, this is issue 10, I'm thinking it's a little bit further down the line than that. And the reason why I bought this in is the women's market is pretty crowded, as we all know, and I think this just does a really, really good job. It's not patronising, it's completely devoid of anything that is you could associate with good housekeeping or another... women's mag, and I just really like it. I just think it's always really nicely produced, and it's fairly free of advertising at the moment, but I think that's increasing. And I just like the way they do it. I think they design it really nice. It's very clean, and I say it doesn't talk down to anybody, and I pick it up as regularly as anybody, I think, in the office, because it does have some really nice typography, and the way they use the typography with the pictures, I think, works really well.
You mentioned a good housekeeping, but where do you think it really sort of sits? I think within the print landscape, because it is interesting that they don't sell their outside back cover, and then you've got sort of the likes of Granta, Paul Smith with the opening spread. So it's there's something incredibly bookish about it.
Maybe that's probably why I see sort of a few parallels with what we've been doing. I mean, we never sell the outside back cover, but that's just the way we've always done it. I don't know. I just think it. I just I've always really enjoyed it. I just think it's a great little publication.
To both of you, and Danny, I'll start with you. Do you think that as we move into a territory where there's so much undefined space as to what's going to happen in 2013, 2014, is advertising going to dry up, for many traditional magazines or not? And there's a lot of question marks over that as well. And we've had many people talk about the fact that, they've actually moved spending back to print. Other people are out of it altogether. Does that put us in a place, though, where the reader needs to become more of a patron? And when I say patron, then they have to they're going to have to cough up and spend, $30 for their favorite magazine. I mean, there's always a discussion we have. People say, oh, there's a lot of advertising now in Monocle. But it's like, if you're going to do the journalism and cover the world, either you have to spend $100 for every issue or you're going to need advertising.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, where do you think we sort of end up on the consumer side?
Well, it's interesting using the word patron, actually. I've not heard that word used before. I was thinking of sort of the sense of an advocate, someone who is really so deeply involved with your magazine. The relationship you have with them is so deep that they're going out, maybe, if you're putting on an event or doing other things with your brand, that they'll be involved with those and they'll be speaking to other people about them. With advertising, such a difficult discussion. I mean, for us, when I think about where advertising... I mean, we try to think of... With Little White Lies especially, we don't think of where adverts are being placed in the mag or online, or if there are other partnership deals, broader partnership deals that we're doing with other organizations or brands. We try to look at the whole picture, basically. And I do think of advertising as partnerships now. We've actually discussed the idea of taking advertising completely out of the magazine and instead just working in much broader partnerships with fewer organizations who we can do bigger deals that we really concentrate on and that really... For me, the most important thing is like offering something to our readers. So we want to be a useful magazine. White Lies is a movie mag, and we want to connect people with film. And I feel like we can only do that through sort of big partnerships with people.
Hmm.
So, undoubtedly, our ad revenue is not dropping. It's much harder to come by. But if we want to push things forward and we want to make the magazine work, then we have to go other places and we have to do other things in every way that we can. And yeah, that for me is about bigger brand partnerships.
How do you see it?
I don't know. It's that dangerous subject of yield, if you like, for advertising. And I think, I don't know, if I can draw an analogy, it's a little bit like TV and radio. You know, when the TV came out, they said radio would die. And obviously radio now is probably as healthy advertising-wise as it's ever been. So I think it's a very similar. I mean, there's loads of analogies you can bring in. You could say it's the same as vinyl. It's the same as film and digital. It's just another way. And I think certainly our advertisers like the fact that they generally tend to stand out because we don't take we have a 20% rule that we don't go over 20%, and if we do, we go up an issue size. So, and we will stick with that. Unfortunately, that's meant that it's killed us on postage in some issues.
Exactly.
Especially during the Tour de France. But, hey, that's just what we have to suck that up. But, I think advertisers are looking for, looking back to print, because I think, as I say, especially with some of the magazines that we've discussed, if you've got an advert in there, it's going to look great because the mag is great. And that, as you say, that partnership, that association you have with that publication then is a closer bond. And I think that's the problem with online as well, is difficult because, you do get lost sometimes. And I think that's what advertisers want to be noticed. So, I think niche media may be the way forward.
Mm. Well, here's someone who, we'll be hearing from someone in a moment who is a bit of a founder of niche, at least in the definition of 90s publishing in New York. In a moment, we're going to be chatting to the former Condé Nast editorial director, James Truman. And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24, where last week was a busy one for visitors from New York here at Midori House. One of the more colorful characters to tour our floors was James Truman, perhaps one of the most famous magazine editors from the heady days of 90s publishing in New York. Having been the creative force on the floors of Condé Nast, Truman has now turned his attention to more pastoral pleasures. He sat down with our editor, Andrew Tuck.
James, let's start with the world of New York publishing. Can you just tell people who don't know a little bit, a quick summary of your career? Because you were... a British journalist who went to America during a period when I think quite a lot of journalists were seeing New York as the place to be if you wanted to move your career along. And it certainly worked for you. You went over there to be the British editor for The Face and Arena and quite quickly moved to work for Condé Nast. What was that like, that transition from being, you know, a jobbing journalist in London to suddenly finding yourself in New York?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was a moment when magazines were probably at their most dynamic, at their kind of peak of cultural import. And there was that tradition in England of publishing, you know, from the street, independent publishing, which I think The Face was kind of the apotheosis of. And at that time, the larger publishing companies were incredibly excited about this. And I got involved with Condé Nast because they wanted to buy The Face. They bought a piece of it, and then we were going to do an American version of it, which actually didn't happen. So that's how I came into the Condé Nast world, which had never been my world. I started in England as a rock critic, and I didn't really pay much attention to the establishment magazines. But then they found, as a, you know, as a bridge to their future, they had an interest in finding what was going on at the fringes of publishing, which, in, you know, in the 80s and 90s was a very dynamic field.
So quite cleverly, you made yourself part of the deal, did you?
Well, I wish I'd been that enterprising. Actually, the owner of The Face, Nick Logan, said he would only make the deal with Condé Nast to do it there if I was the editor, which was an extremely generous gesture on his part.
Thank you, Nick Logan.
Yes.
Now, when you got to Condé Nast, they quickly saw in you a man who could run this magazine, Details. And Details, I think, you know, for everybody who remembers it at that time, was an extraordinary product, because I think today, if you were trying to launch a men's magazine and you presented them Details, especially in this very kind of, it's either conservative market or a kind of completely sex-driven market, Details did something that it was a modern gentleman's magazine in a way, but it wasn't really about gentlemen. It did amazing rock and roll writing, good investigations, really wonderful photography. It had an offbeat look at what fashion was about. How were you ever able to bring that magazine to market and make it a success?
I think it was about the moment. I mean, I look back on Details, and I think it was one of the last magazines that got through before the internet changed paper publishing forever. And we just gave ourselves endless license. I don't think Condé Nast really knew what they got themselves into. We were not in the Condé Nast building. We were downtown. There wasn't a lot of communication between us. So we just went off on our own tangent and kind of did things in the postmodern vision of the world of things that interested us. I mean, one of the things I'm proud of with Details is I think we were the first mainstream magazine to openly talk about gay and heterosexual relationships as being sort of equal options for young men to live by. And as you say, you know, we combined some investigative journalism with some lifestyle journalism, with some music journalism. And I think we had the first interview with Carlos Castaneda. He'd given in 20 years. So we delved into mysticism and drugs and all kinds of other things. So it was this kaleidoscopic view of the contemporary world.
You really understood how Condé Nast worked and what its aspirations were. Can you tell us how your empire expanded while you were there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd been at Details 4 years, and then there had been this one legendary editorial director in the company's history, Alexander Lieberman, and he was in his 80s and thinking to retire. So there'd been this large question mark over the company for 10 years about who was going to replace Alex. And I was certainly the surprise choice because they kind of skipped a generation in giving it to me. I was 34 years old. So suddenly I found myself going from being this sort of downtown rebel to having to be at company corporate HQ every day and overseeing this stable of 17 magazines, you know, with a lot of very well-established editors who were older than me and probably felt themselves to be more accomplished than me. So it was an interesting learning in the skills of diplomacy, among other things.
Now, you talked a little bit earlier about the rise of the internet. This is a period that when your career starts where it's really having no impact on the world of publishing. And already by the end of it, it is having quite an influence. The world of gourmet is gone. There's been a real audit of all publishers' magazines as they kind of look at their successes. And they've been brutal, especially in 2008, and what they got rid of. Do you think we've lost a golden moment of publishing, or do you feel that there is a sense of renewal going on and that we'll come out the other side with another range of magazines a fit for the time?
No, I think it's over. I mean, I think it's gone. One of the reasons why I wanted to leave Condé Nast was all I could see in my future was 10 years of cost cutting, because essentially magazine companies were monopolies. There was a very high barrier to entry for new, particularly in America, not so much in England, but for new companies to come in. So, you know, like when any monopoly is disassembled, it's a traumatic and turbulent time, and it doesn't come back. And, you know, almost overnight, it seemed that the model had gone from being kind of top down of, you know, editorial judgment, where there was this figurehead of an editor who knew exactly what the public wanted in their millions, to it being bottom up and, you know, individualistic opinion that people had access to and could create their own content for. I mean, it's monumental, the change that happened and how fast it happened. And I don't believe the magazine business as we knew it will ever recover. I don't think it will ever be the force it was.
I mean, when you go to the newsstand, I mean, we're talking here about the printed product, and you look at that printed product, do you think it's as good today as it was even 10 years ago? Because I think we have some discussion here that actually when you open these magazines, often the way the photographs are reprinted, the kind of the technical care, the belief in the use of fonts, it all seems to be a bit corroded. And you pick up a copy of Vogue actually from 10 years ago or other titles from all publishers, and you put them against the title from today, and you can't wonder if they weren't actually a bit better back then. Is that cost cutting? Is that a kind of a loss of the belief in craft?
Yeah, I think there's a crisis of confidence among anyone who's working in, you know, large magazine media at this point. And I think you feel that in the pages. So, it might manifest as cheaper paper. It might manifest as a hastier design that hasn't gone through two or three or four revisions, which used to be the case because there isn't time to do that anymore because the same staff is doing the, you know, the iPad app and so forth. And then I just think it's the you know, when something is on a roll, you feel it. It's just that intangible feeling that it of confidence and esprit and connection with its audience that goes when, you know, when the business model is eroded and when culturally the magazine is not at the center of the world anymore, and it surely isn't.
And you, as a consumer, do you still buy print, or do you find yourself actually going with the flow and reading some of the things you used to love on print on an iPad? Are you somebody who's swishing their finger across a screen these days?
Yeah, I mean, I've come to look at magazines really as being like department stores. I mean, they stay in business, but you wonder why, since you couldn't get everything in them somewhere else. And, you know, how magazines get out of that sort of department store crisis is really going to be the story of the next 10 years, and there's not an easy path out. Marshall McLuhan, I think, had one of the most interesting theories about what happens to obsolete technologies, and I do think the print is largely an obsolete technology. He used the example of the horse and car, and basically what happened to the horse. He followed the path of how it was ultimately 30, 40 years later reborn as a luxury good, that the horse went from being a utilitarian form of transport to being sort of, you know, Muffy's expensive Saturday afternoon hobby. And we can follow that through a number of different things. He used another beautiful example of what happened to the stars after the invention of the compass, that actually they became a luxury good. We then went into the realm of astrology and thought of them as spiritual objects, where previously they'd merely saved lives and allowed sailors to navigate. So I mean, I do see some possibility for print, and I think actually Monocle does this quite well, that when it is no longer useful as a news device or as a utilitarian, efficiently calibrated media for disseminating information in particular, there is a role for it as a luxury good. So, you know, I think we'll see magazines move closer to books. On one end, we'll see it move closer to sort of brochures and pamphlets at the cheap end. The craft of magazines, to disagree with what I said earlier, I mean, does have a role going forward. I just don't think it's going to be in the hands of the people who previously owned the high ground of the print technology.
Well, let's talk about James Truman after print, or with a bit of print still going on, but how you repositioned yourself and your career after the world of Condé Nast. You're now a man who's involved with all sorts of things, from food and drink, and I understand that's perhaps one of the reasons you're here in London. Could you tell us, where did your career go after you left Condé Nast Towers?
Oh, straight down the crapper. No, I mean, when I left Condé Nast, I felt I'd done my career, and I was not particularly interested in having a second career. I was interested in doing projects that interested me, some of which are, you know, for love, and some of which are for cash flow. I mean, I spent 2 years starting a circus. If there's a worse business than magazines, I could say it is a circus. But I was interested actually in much more personal connection than I was in media, part of which is sitting on top of a large organization is a rather alienating experience. And so I liked the idea of getting my hands dirty. I mean, I'm now, one of the things I'm doing is overseeing an organic farm in upstate New York, and which is literally getting your hands dirty. I'm interested in pre-media experience. I mean, I think that's possibly part of my own passage of having gotten bored with what I was doing. So those elemental essential things like food and drink, like being in the presence of interesting people, these things have eternal appeal. They're unmediated experiences, and that is actually a post-media point of view, I suppose, to want unmediated experience.
And that was James Truman, Condé Nast's former editorial director and a man of many new talents, talking to our editor, Andrew Tuck. Gentlemen, to both of you, Guy, why don't we start with you? It was interesting how he said, you know, when we're looking at sort of this next phase of publishing, that maybe, you know, the hands of magazines as we know them right now are not going to be controlled maybe by these big groups anymore, and that I guess what he's suggesting is, you know, maybe a much more sort of, you know, disparate and patchy world, and just many, many more players perhaps doing niche things. Does that seem like a likely prediction to you?
Yes, I think he's spot on with that. I'm still marveling with the fact that they were thinking about doing The Face in America, but anyway. As he said, you know, the sort of throwaway nature of magazines nowadays and the care that isn't taken with a lot of the mainstream mags, that's where we pick up. You know, I mean, we were talking as well about print quality and who does your printing, and I think those things matter to people who have more control over their product. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, a magazine is a product and it has to be good. So
absolutely,
and I think he was saying that then. So, you know, more power to us, I guess.
Yeah, Danny?
Yeah, I agree with Guy completely. I think the opportunity for guys like us and companies like us is just amazing at the moment. We're completely focused around our print editions, but with the websites that we're making and all the different ways we have to connect with the communities around us, I feel like with White Lies, our competitors printing 10 times more copies than us, but online, we have this opportunity to connect with 10 times more people than they do, if we do it right, and we can do. You know, we're working really hard on it. We're a small, nimble company who can really put all of our attention into a new website or other platforms and think about things differently. I think it's really hard for big companies. It's really hard for them to turn their ship around and do new things. And it really, I'm not going to say it's easy for us. We find it a little difficult too, but it can be done. So yeah, I think this is a great time for us and a fantastic opportunity.
Great. We're going to take a very short break. You're listening to The Stack. We're back in a moment.
J. Crew's designers are constantly pushing boundaries with hopes of making the best clothing available today. As head menswear designer Frank Malchin says, every garment J. Crew produces requires attention to detail, meaning the little things are as important as the most obvious.
We don't leave a stone unturned. Like, every detail is important to us. Every component of a garment gets a lot of attention, different button shapes, everything, like even stitches per inch is important to us, you know. And for an outsider, it might not look like something, but even the stitch color is important. Like, all those little things people sometimes take for granted, and then people maybe don't realize that there's a thought process behind that as well.
J. Crew.
Mm-hmm. And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24, talking to Danny Miller and Guy Andrews. Guy, I was mentioning at the top of the program a great title, not necessarily from The Bosphorus, Covers The Bosphorus, which is a cornucopia, a title which is very limited distribution. I always walk around the corner and pick it up at Daunt, but it's amazing how, you know, year after year, and I think it's had some patchy moments as well, just trying to get copies out, but it's just so obsessive, and the way it sort of just focuses on, all that's Turkish and Ottoman, but I brought you the latest issue, which I grabbed last weekend, and just wondering what you make of it.
It's not the kind of magazine I'd first pick up. Mm. Looking at the cover,
no, because it's a very traditional format too. It's incredibly indulgent, but it's not bookish, and it actually lives in a bookish environment because I only ever find it at Daunt. But
well, it's full of surprises. I mean, I've just picked it up and started reading this article here, Brave New World, which is about the village institutes that helped educate young Turkish kids, and it's amazing. Mm. I mean, the pictures are beautiful. I mean, obviously there is a big backstory here, which I don't know anything about, have to say. But yeah, no, fantastic. And this is the sort of thing that I just love, this sort of stuff, because, you know, it's the stuff that, as I was saying, you know, I was saying on top of the show, you know, Picture Post and View magazine and those magazines from the sort of early part of the 20th century that spent time, you know, researching and putting all the pictures together.
Well, you referenced Reportage, and as I was watching you know, flip through it, it also to me reminds me also of, you know, Stern magazine in the late 60s and, you know, early 70s, when it was largely black and white, it's that type of storytelling, which you just don't, and I think, well, that story seems to be told over 16 pages or something.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, that's good, it's really indulgent from that point of view, but I think what's lovely about it as well photographically is it's one of those things. I was talking to Jerry Badger, the photo writer, about this sort of thing, and he was saying to me that there are photographers that take pictures of certain things, and they may not be the best photographers in the world, but they've spent their life taking pictures of this, whatever it may be. And in this instance, it's the Village Institutes in Turkey, and it's just an incredible collection because you can see the time, you know, as you go through the pictures. And that's the sort of thing I look for in magazines. You know, if I see that element of time and care taking over something, that I get excited about that. That's fantastic.
And that sort of notion of niche, I love the passion of just, you know, jumping in a singular topic. Of course, the Ottoman world is not that small, and you can cover it on multiple levels. But I like that how you can have sort of this historical approach, and you said jump into something which you just never know about, as much as they can also then go and do a great architectural piece, from somewhere else in the country.
Well, they're on issue 48.
Yeah,
so they're produced in Edinburgh.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, how niche is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Dan, in front of you, you've got something which hit our desk this week, which is El Deco. So it's from the El Decoration franchise. And I think as we were just sort of talking about, perhaps, the transformation that major publishers have to go through, I thought this was an interesting magazine. It's called El Deco Lab. Different paper stock. They've rethought the trim size. It feels much more indie. Here you have one of the world's biggest, publishing groups, and certainly one of the biggest, franchises in the fashion and design sector. It feels like it could be from a very small atelier in the suburbs of Paris, maybe.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm only 1 hour into my relationship with this magazine, but it's beautiful. The typography looks like it's by their creative agency Nonforma, and I don't know if that is actually the case, but it's the typography throughout the magazine is absolutely stunning, and the pacing of the magazine, it doesn't feel like I would expect this a mag with this kind of content to feel. The photography is also really beautiful throughout, very warm, and I've never had to deal with this personally. We've translated a lot of magazines into different languages, but this is running English and French alongside each other, which I can only imagine is an enormous challenge. But really, it looks great, and they're kind of treating the two languages quite differently in terms of the design. There's some really interesting articles here as well. There's an article about 12 inspiring blogs, and there's another kind of a really fun piece.
And interesting how the magazine almost opens on that story, which I thought, normally it would get buried somewhere else, but...
No, they're running front and center with that. And there's some really great blogs here, some ones I'm familiar with. And then there's a fun piece about 10 French designers who were dropped in the textile aisle at IKEA and allowed to let their creativity flow. So it's obviously something that, while it's very, as that sort of austere feel about it, it doesn't take itself too seriously.
Mm. I'm wondering what you think, Guy, was there a meeting at a very corporate level in Paris, and someone, you know, perhaps sort of brought up a copy of Apartmento and said, "Okay, we need a piece of this.
One of those, please.
Yeah, we'll have one of these through our company." And it was really probably prescribed at that level, or does it strike you that something that it maybe actually sort of organically flowed up from the editorial floor? I don't know what your first.
I think certainly. I mean, as Danny said, I've not had much chance to look at this, but I think certainly they've realised that there is a young market that's interested in interior design. So I suppose they've looked at the magazines that young people are buying. Mm. And I guess, as you rightly say, it has a very indie feel to it. I mean, I like it.
Yeah. Are architecture and design titles a part of your monthly, weekly diet?
I can't say they are. I'm obviously interested, but no, I can't say they are. But this is the sort of thing that we would definitely look at. I mean, as Danny was saying, some of the typography and the way they've actually dealt with the page layouts is really sophisticated, and I guess that's power to their elbow, really, because you know they can probably afford to spend time doing that.
Yeah.
But
okay, so it looks like El Deco's lab, bilingual, gets a thumbs up.
Yeah.
What do you have? What haven't we hit? You had Carl's Car. What do you want to talk about next? We've got some, or maybe you've got a vintage magazine.
I've got a vintage magazine. I just can't help myself.
No, but it's great.
I just find I could pass this round. The thing is, what was extraordinary about this magazine, which I bought off eBay, is that every page I open, I spend time looking at. And it's pretty rare you find that with a magazine of any age. Maybe it's just me, but you know, it's full of illustration. It's full of, I mean, it's just the time that
Quattrute. It's
Italian.
Well, just the cover too.
Yeah, the cover's beautiful. But I think what I was actually thinking on this on the way down is that what is amazing about that magazine, and also a lot of the magazines that we've been discussing, is the element of feel of collaboration. You know, every magazine that I suppose I like, and I know that Danny likes, is born from a team. You know, it's born from a not just an individual, as you probably would find with a blog or you know a website sometimes, but it has that feeling of collaboration. And in that, what I love about it is that it has everything that I think a magazine should have. You know, it has illustration, it has great photography, it has some quite interesting opinion pieces. Obviously, they're in Italian, so I'm not sure on their opinion, but I think that's the amazing thing about it. And as I say, there's a page, you know, you'll find a page and you'll stay staring at it.
Well, yeah, I couldn't get beyond the flying car. And the edition there is 1959, which is amazing. And it's, you can pick up sort of a vintage trail like that. It's got such a wonderful feel to it. I love that it's on a matte, almost newspapery stock. But then there's just these hits of colors, largely black and white. But it's absolutely beautifully done. We probably have time for one more very quickly, just before
from,
we go.
From yeah. Me? Well, Cars, Cars. I mean, I presume many of the listeners are familiar with Cars, Cars. And in a sense, I bought these two because they're kind of quite an interesting juxtaposition. But, you know, it's also the fact that what I love about Cars, Cars. I mean, I like cars, but I don't like car magazines. But and that obviously Cars, Cars is, they say it's a magazine about people, but it does generally tend to have a lot of cars in it. And again, it's the same thing. I just love looking at it. It's just a great, it's just a great magazine to look at. But
it's absolutely cool.
Yeah, sure. I think they only do two issues a year now. I'm not sure. I've kind of got a little bit out of touch with them. And I think I've noticed a lot of magazines that started out when Cars, Cars started, because they were kind of ahead of the game with independent publishing. Have tended to do less magazines and get more quality.
Great. So. We're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. It brings us to the end of edition 6 of The Stack. My guests today have been Danny Miller and Guy Anders. Our producers were John Trump and Adrian Craddock, and also Katie Bilbao has been sitting in. Our studio manager is Ben Jay. If you have any comments or queries for the show, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. We have a special interview with Martha Stewart. Here's a listen.
And we thought, and all statistics showed, that right away, within the first 12 months, we would have about 9% of our readership on the digital issue. However, that hasn't happened. Because despite the great number of iPads that have been sold and other tablets, the adoption of the digital magazine has not occurred so rapidly.
And we'll have much more from Martha Stewart at some length next week here on The Stack. Also, from Monday morning, there'll be a new addition to Hyatt's Churchill Hotel in London. We're opening up a newsstand. It's our first Monocle shop within a hotel. It's going to be stocked with lots of our favorite titles. I think some that were discussed here today as well. As ever, you can, of course, download this program via iTunes. Also, you can find it via monocle.com on our Time Shift player for now. I'm going to be on the road next week, so this seat is going to be taken up by someone else. Then the week after, we're going to be coming to you from our new digs in Toronto. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye from Studio One here in London. Have a good weekend.